Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside, suburbs of New York City in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling, JJ Devaney, an international break.
What's up, Andrew? We usually curse the international break. It's usually a time of, ugh.
I know.
It's usually the time when NBC Sports Soccer Twitter just tweets out how many days till Premier League returns. But this feels like a palate cleanser, a break.
We are at
Rancho Relaxo.
I was wondering if I was the only one who felt this way, because you're right. At this stage in the season, when like normally all the domestic leagues are kind of hitting their pinnacle and it's like this sprint and you don't want the sprint to be interrupted, but maybe it's just because of the club that I support and like the moment in time that they're in. And I'm just like, get me away from this. I was actually angry that they played over the weekend. I was like, I don't want to be around you right now.
At least
I want my international. They did win, but I just was like, I want my international break. I want to just relax a little. I even brought in some.
Can you hear that?
Yeah. Oh, just breathe.
Feel the tension leave your sacrum.
Close your eyes. A week of not having to think about Jose Mourinho.
Your feet are in the water. The water laps at your feet, relaxing you in the way that Steve Bruce will never do.
And breathe. All right, international break.
Good stuff. Nice little break there. By the way, I kicked a soccer ball in an organized game for the first time on Sunday in 18 months.
Oh my goodness. And you're okay? Or if you were to stand up and walk right now, would the limp be just like so pronounced you'd look like an 85-year-old man? Or what are we talking here?
I'd look like the scene in The Irishman where Robert De Niro goes to beat up the grocer when he's walking down the street. He has the face of a 45-year-old, but the legs and gait of a 77-year-old. That's who I am right now. By the way, I love Marty. Marty is one of my favorite people on planet Earth, and I think he's one of the most creative people in the world. And as a fellow New Yorker, I just adore him. But Marty, body doubles for those scenes. Come on.
You know what it felt like? You ever see like the Jackass movies, JJ, where Johnny Knoxville will put on the makeup of a 95-year-old man? And it's like, we all know what's going on. Like you still are the kind of the body and movements of a young, in shape individual, but your face, like also the movie J. Edgar, like when they just put on like 90-year-old makeup for Leonardo DiCaprio and they're like, Leo, move slower. It's like, no, we all still know what's going on here.
Yeah.
The tech quite working the way you thought it would in your head.
Bit like Gareth Bale this season as well. Back in a Spurs jersey, so you're expecting him to be rollicking down the wing like he was when he was like 20, 21, but not the case. But no, it was great to play. Great to get out in the sunshine. I have just one quick admission that I have to make. So we're organizing the team before the game. And we're playing a team that are from New Jersey. They're called Club America. They keep the ball really well, better than we will. They're technically very good. And suddenly I'm given instructions and I'm saying things like, let them have it in front of us. We're going to be compact.
Oh my God.
Yes.
You're a monster.
Defend the edges of the 18. If there's bodies in between the goal and the ball, it doesn't matter how deep we are. They're not scoring for 20, 30 yards. And when we get it, we look to break quickly. And I just thought, I am Jose Mourinho. I am Sam Allardyce. I am Sam Mourinho.
How did it go? Did it work? Did you win?
Yeah, we won 6-0. Yeah, no, they were significantly reduced in their talent. They were still good, but they didn't have as many players because of, I mean, interstate restrictions. You know, so the guys that play for the club, which is based in Jersey, that live in New York, they were all there. But the Jersey guys didn't travel because they'd have to quarantine for X amount of days when they go back. But whatever. Anyway, that's just my story.
This is all very interesting. Yeah.
The hypocrisy of me. And also, it just goes to show how easy it is to set up that system. But whatever.
This should be a fun podcast that we have coming up. I know, you know, we're joking a little bit about international break. I'm actually deadly serious that I was like thrilled that it was here. I know that not everyone shares that sentiment. If you're, you know, like a Manchester City supporter or anyone whose club is flying right now, you're probably not thrilled about this, but I feel like the majority of people may be of a like mind that you were ready for this. The U.S. has a couple games coming up, over the next few days. So we're going to kind of preview those. Going to preview UEFA World Cup qualifying, which begins today. By the time you're hearing this podcast, some of these games may have happened already. We're going to speak with Jan Aga Fjortoft, Norwegian former player, now works for ESPN FC. You see his work all the time ever since Erling Haaland has kind of risen to prominence. I feel like it's kind of lifted the entire Norwegian media and him none more so.
I'd like to give Jan Aga Fjortoft his credit because he worked for Visasport, and his post-match interviews are just so candid that the Champions League elevated him to a new level. He's just so, I think he interviewed the Dortmund players after the bus bombing.
Okay, yeah.
And he's just, I don't know, maybe it's because he's an ex-footballer. He knows how to talk to footballers and get the best out of them, but he's so interesting. And there's a lot going on in Norway too that we need to talk about.
Yeah, it's not even just Haaland. It's whether or not, let's say Haaland and Odegaard lead them to World Cup qualification. Will Norway even take part? As there's been talk of a World Cup boycott circulating through that country. So we'll talk with him about whether or not that's a real possibility. We've got a mailbag here, JJ, which looks very nice. We've got red cards, man/woman of the match. There's a lot to get to. Let's start though with the U.S. because, like I said, they've got games coming up the next couple of days, tomorrow and Sunday, Jamaica and then Northern Ireland. This is, of course, a U.S. international camp based in Europe right now. And I guess I just, as we do leading up to some of these U.S. Friendlies, it's more so about not always results, but about like the process, how things are looking, who we're most excited about watching, what we're most curious to see Greg Berhalter do with this team. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts leading into this. I feel like, you know, for whatever my domestic league excitement is right now, my U.S. men excitement is on high, even though that this is just an international break. I'm so into this team. And whenever we have the chance to watch them play, I'm excited about it. So I have some thoughts here. I have three players in particular that I will be most interested in.
I'm curious to see what our crossover is because I have 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay. And we have not spoken beforehand, so we could have potentially a lot of crossover. I have a feeling this first name will be on both of our lists. I am really, really intrigued by what is happening with Daryl DK right now.
Boom. Number one.
Yeah. And not only because of what he's doing at Barnsley, 5 goals in his first 11 games on loan at this club. When Barnsley, I think, announced this, I don't know that supporters of that club were, you know, like partying in the streets with this announcement. I don't think they quite understood what they were getting. I don't even know if American fans or even Orlando City fans knew exactly.
Daryl DK? Who's Daryl DK? We need to strike it, put ball in net. We don't need Daryl DK from stupid the MLS to MLS.
But, I mean, you look at not just the success that he's had. Obviously, you know, soccer is a team game, but since his arrival in 10 championship matches since DK has arrived at that club, they've won 9 and drew 1. They are now in the playoff picture in the championship. And again, he's not all of what it's been about, but he's certainly been a much larger part of it than I think anybody, American fan or Barnsley fan, expected. And so I'm just so curious to see if this form translates to playing with this American team, how he'll be used, how much we'll see of him over the course of these next 180 minutes or so. So, and just the fact, of course, that it's the position on this U.S. team that we're all so curious about, who is going to step up and fill, I'll say, the perceived void. There may not be a void. It may still be Jozy Altidore's spot to lose. It may be Josh Sargent's spot to lose. But for whatever reason, we all seem to feel that there's a void at the striker position that someone can claim. And so I'm guessing DK will get a shot here.
Yeah, and I think I've been impressed by his ability in the air, his physicality. You know, the championship, we always talk about, it's a tough league, and he has just hit the ground running there. He's also been, you know, we talk about his physicality. He seems to be a tidy finisher. And And you know, the perceived gap is not a perceived gap, Andrew. There are people in the fan base, whether we like it or not, who want to move on from Jozy Altidore, and they want to see options up front in the European game. And he has presented himself as a real option. He's also a stunningly charismatic speaker. Whenever you hear him talk, he is so happy about life, happy about his situation, happy about being a professional footballer. And it's infectious. And I think he's someone that, I mean, when is he not smiling? When is he not happy? I think he enlivens the camp in that way too, off the field.
Yeah, 20 years old, and he's, why shouldn't he be happy? I mean, my goodness, this is what it's all about. He's on a loan move. It's in Europe. It's going great. He's on the U.S. men's national team picture. He's going to get some minutes, I'm sure. So yeah, life is good if you're Daryl DK right now. Another 20-year-old JJ, whose life is also good, who I'm also very curious about, that is Brendan Aaronson. This was actually a very easy trip for him. I think he said it was only like a 3-hour drive for him to get from Salzburg to where this U.S. camp is in Vienna. He has also, much like DK, has kind of hit the ground running in this European move. 9 starts in 13 matches. I think he's appeared in all of them. 3 goals, 2 assists. I mean, he has made an instant impact at Salzburg for Jesse Marsch. And so, you know, again, like he's also come on. We've seen him a little bit more so than we've seen with DK. We've gotten better looks of Aaronson playing with the U.S. a little bit more. And you know, it's funny because he doesn't even know exactly how it is that I think he's going to be used by Berhalter. He talked about, you know, if they want to play me.
Join the queue.
But he said, like, if they want to play me more centrally, that's cool with me. If they want to play me on the wing, I'll do it. If they want me to be a more defensive lying position, I'll do that. So I think his versatility, it can only help him. And, you know, like I said, DK's 20, Aaronson's 20. It's kind of like this next wave of young talent. And I'm equally excited to see what he can do.
Can I jump in with someone who we haven't really spoken about very much on this podcast, who's slightly older, 4 years older, Jordan Sibichu from Young Boys Bern, center forward, 10 goals in 24 outings in the Swiss League. French under 21 international, capped twice for them, but certainly, certainly a player in form. And certainly yet another striking option. Again, we talk about the chasm at center forward. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. If anything, Berhalter has the tricky decision of trying to pare this down to exactly what he wants.
Do you think, I just get the sense from U.S. soccer Twitter, we all still don't know what Greg Berhalter thinks of Jozy Altidore. Like, again, the reason I keep using the word perceived chasm or void at strikers, because like, we, the fans, feel that way, but we don't know. We haven't seen really Berhalter oversee a major tournament for this team and who he would prefer at that position. There may, like, if Jozy Altidore lines up that position, I'm not ready to say right now if that would be right or wrong. I'm leaning towards maybe being ready to see another guy take that spot. But I don't think I'm quite as like militant on that view as a lot of U.S. soccer Twitter is. There will be a revolt, JJ, if, and I feel bad saying it, Jozy, he's not a bad guy. He's not a bad player. But I feel like for whatever reason, this fan base, well, I say they view him as part of the old guard. And there's just so many fans who are ready to move on from that last era. And unfortunately for Altidore, I feel like among the fans' perspective, he is kind of collateral damage of that.
Well, I think we should factor in, though, Andrew, that in the only game of any significance in terms of competitiveness that the U.S. have played under Berhalter, which was the 2019 Gold Cup final, Altidore started at center forward. Now, right. We know about the goal, the missed chances. We know about some of his hold-up play in that game. But, you know, he has gone to Altidore before. And, you see it with Sebastian Legette too. I know he's not technically, he doesn't really straddle into the old guard era, but certainly he's someone that's been involved. Michael Bradley started that game too. We don't yet know what Altidore fully thinks of, or what Berhalter thinks of Altidore, but we're going to find out fairly soon, I would imagine.
Yeah. One other player I wanted to mention here. This one is a little bit more cliche, I suppose. It's a name I mentioned a couple minutes ago too. And that's Josh Sargent. Again, the position, but also, I don't know. I feel like he was a little bit slower maybe to develop
Yeah.
after his move to the Bundesliga. And now it seems like we're in this moment where it's happening. 3 goals in his last 4 matches, 5 goals this season. No one on the club has more. The team as a whole is playing better. I think that was a problem for a while. No one could really get him in the right positions. They were not playing well, but they have started to turn it around. You know, we never question anything about Josh Sargent's work rate. You know, I was looking at some of the stats on him at Bundesliga.com. He's covered the 3rd most ground of anyone in the Bundesliga so far this season, leads the club in sprints, leads the club in challenges won from a forward position. So, you know, we know that his work rate is always going to be top notch. The question with him since he's made this move is whether or not his finishing ability could equal that of his work rate. And it hadn't up to this point. And maybe now we're starting to see it. So again, much like DK, a player who's in form at a position that we kind of crave someone of that caliber, I'd love to see him get some time as well. Now, he'll only be a part of the Northern Ireland match because of travel restrictions. Werder Bremen allowed him to take part in just the 2nd game. So that would be the chance to get a look at him. And I hope we do, because he's playing well and I want to see it translate internationally.
Yeah, it's not just goals for me. I keep saying this about Josh Sargent, Andrew. I just honestly believe that there's more to his game. And I'm excited about the way, if he gets the start, if he does play for the United States, becomes a regular center forward, how he'll bring other players into the game. That's what fascinates me.
Yeah. In terms of stuff that I'm concerned about, I guess that I kind of want to keep like an eye on through this. This is something that you brought up on our last podcast, I think it was. It was something also that Matt Doyle, when you went through some of his concerns with what was going on with the U.S. men, that I think he may have mentioned in that kind of laundry list of issues, and that is goalkeeper. And yeah. And I say this not to necessarily cite it as a weakness, but, you know, like you said, our top 2 keepers right now, at least on their squads, you know, Zach Steffen, Ethan Horvath, neither play regularly for their club. Horvath just 3 appearances this year. Steffen pretty much just the domestic cup keeper for Manchester City. Again, it's not to say that that doesn't mean they're quality enough to be the number 1 for the U.S. men, but I guess my antenna goes up anytime we're going to ask somebody to be our guy at a position who doesn't play regularly for his club. That's all.
Yeah. It's a worry for me. It's a concern. It's something that's happening with the Republic of Ireland right now. Can you get away with it for a short period of time? A listener from Baltimore pointed out quite rightly that for 2.5 years, at least, Sergio Romero was number 1 for Argentina, but he was not the number 1 for Manchester United. Mm-hmm. But that's not an ideal scenario whatsoever. And Romero talked about, I think last year, I mean, he played 7 games in like 4 years for Manchester United. That's not what you want. You don't get better at something by not doing it regularly. And there's a pressure that needs to be brought. So you would hope. Where does Steffen go? Ederson is not going anywhere. He's too young. Steffen needs another loan move. That's the bald facts of it. And Steffen, the up-and-coming Manchester United keeper from the academy is Banazu from Ireland, who is on loan at Rochdale. So he's getting games. And Steffen's getting games in the cup. Is that enough? We'll see.
Yeah. So what constitutes a successful international break for this team? I mean, first and foremost, just no one get hurt.
Like, yeah, that's part of it, Andrew. I think what's interesting about this for me is that there should be 2 wins. Jamaica are significantly weakened, so the U.S. men's national team need to put them away. There's no Mikel Antonio, no Leon Bailey. Bobby Reid is out, no Kamar Lawrence. Against Northern Ireland, they've made progression over 6 or 7 years to be like a difficult draw in European football and UEFA qualifying, but they are not a top-tier team. For me, the phony war is over, though, Andrew, because right on the horizon this summer and in the fall with World Cup qualifying, there are games that really matter. So we need to see a plan. We need to see things coming together, and we need to have a better idea of what Greg Berhalter's starting 11 is going to be. And I think it starts this week. It really starts in earnest this week, because we're within touching distance of games that matter.
Yeah, it's a little bit unfortunate that Weston McKennie's not able to take part as he's dealing with a bit of a knock, but they will have Christian Pulisic in this camp. Tyler Adams, you know, we mentioned some of these other names as well. So you're right. I think we can get a good sense. Sergiño Dest coming off a game for Barcelona where he scored twice. So, you know, hopefully we'll get a good sense of what Berhalter views as his 11 to be. And look, this is a team, the U.S. men over their last 3 friendlies have scored 19 goals. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that they can continue at that rate, But like you used the term phony war. Like it was hard for us to understand what the six goals, seven goals, what those meant because of the context of the competition that they came against, weakened sides. You know, I think Jamaica is, even with the players that they're missing, perhaps a step up from some of the teams that the U.S. did that to, Northern Ireland as well. So I'm not saying I need to see that kind of quantity of goals, but you know, I still think this is a team that shouldn't necessarily be held to like a narrow 1-0 or a, you know, an ugly 0-0. Like I think this team should be able to take it to this opposition and get some goals.
I think so too. And I actually think the Northern Ireland game, because Jamaica again is not, it's not the Jamaica we're going to see in the fall, we expect. But the Northern Ireland game is a good measure because we've seen Northern Ireland be organized, be tough, qualify for tournaments. And it will really be a measure of how far the Bearhalter project has moved on.
Should be fun. So like we said, I believe it's tomorrow, depending on when you're listening. Thursday is the Jamaica match. Sunday, the Northern Ireland match. So yeah, all eyes will be on that for at least the two of us and all of you listening, I'm sure, out there as well. We'll have a podcast next week where we'll break down everything that we saw from that, whose stock is up, whose stock was declining afterwards, the key performers, what we liked, what we didn't like, a total complete breakdown of those two matches. So I'm looking forward to that. Let's shift though now to UEFA, where World Cup qualifying begins today. We're going to talk with Jan-Åge Fjørtoft about some issues in Norway, Erling Haaland and his emergence, this potential World Cup boycott because of the World Cup being staged in Qatar. He'll join us in just a couple minutes. But before we get to that, I guess it's worth at least giving people the quick refresher course for UEFA qualifying. 13 slots are available to European teams for the World Cup. We've got 10 groups of either five or six nations in each group. Group winners, the simplest way to get through, win your group, you qualify automatically. Bang, done. Then it gets a little trickier, JJ, because like the Nations League, I feel like that noise you just made, it should almost be part of like the Nations League trademark. Like, I feel like everyone kind of has that sound.
Yeah, you know,
it mucks up the simplicity of these competitions. And like,
we've got dramatic music for the Europa League now. Oh, you know, we got all that. And instead Nations League, it should be the Nations League.
So 10 group runners up will be joined by the best two Nations League group winners based on Nations League overall rankings. But those winners or those teams will have to have finished outside the top two of their qualifying group.
Yes.
Have fun making sense of that as this tournament is progressing.
Look, do well in your Nations League group and you're guaranteed a playoff, unless you've already automatically qualified via the regular qualification.
Right. In which case you could have done, I guess, mediocre in your Nations League and have a route through. So Correct. Basically we'll be left with 12 teams that are going to be drawn into three playoff paths. So kind of like three mini tournaments. They'll play two rounds of single match playoffs, semifinals and a final, with the home teams to be drawn. And then those three winners from those three mini tournaments will also qualify. That's how we'll get to 13.
The same debacle that we just went through with qualification for the 2020-2021 European Championships that'll happen this summer. Same nonsense. So let's just focus on qualifying proper.
Win your group.
Win your group. Finish second in your group.
Simple enough. So some of the stuff, obviously, we should go through that, I guess, kind of is intriguing to us as UEFA World Cup qualifying gets underway. And I'll start with one that I have now.
Okay.
People may be getting sick of this. But I really feel here today, what is this, March 24th, if I had to identify my, I guess, somewhat dark horse World Cup winner, I'm looking at Portugal. And I've said that multiple times. They have Azerbaijan later today, a game that they should have very little trouble with. But they're my dark horse. I'll just go through, you know, looking at this team right now. Defense, you've got João Cancelo, Ruben Dias, Pepe, who, you know, people may laugh at that, but he's still playing well in the Champions League. Rafael Guerrero, move up to the midfield, Ruben Neves, Bernardo Silva, Bruno Fernandes up front. Cristiano Ronaldo is still terrifying to opposing defenses. Diego Jota, we're seeing what he's doing for Liverpool. João Felix, who, you know, maybe things are progressing a little slower for him at Atletico Madrid, but I think he's still a player that can inspire fear. And André Silva, by the way, who has 21 goals and 4 assists in 24 Bundesliga starts this season for Eintracht Frankfurt. I mean, this team is loaded in a way that even for Portuguese standards, I think their fans are looking at this with both eyes wide open at what this team could achieve.
Yeah, I don't think because they're Portugal, you'll slot them into the dark horse zone. But this is a team that I watched them in the Nations League, I believe, against France in the fall of last year. And they were very, very impressive. Now, we know how they do play, Andrew, which is a little more conservative considering all the talent that you listed there. So I'm going to wonder, is this a team that's going to want to be a bit more expressive, come out and play a little bit more? Because if they do, there's enough talent there, attacking talent there, to be deadly. I'm intrigued by Belgium and the matchup of Belgium v Wales, which is on today. It's a replay of the Euro 2016 quarterfinal and that famous win for the Welsh. But this is a big game. The next 2 years, basically, because we're in this rare scenario now. We have meaningful competitive games smack bang prior to the European Championships, which they've already qualified for. So if you look at this summer and the qualification campaign and the following year, this is it all on the line for the golden generation of Belgian football and Roberto Martinez. They're getting up there. If you look at the ages of Kevin De Bruyne, Alderweireld, Hazard the Elder, maybe replaced in importance considering his injuries by Hazard the Younger, Dries Mertens, if not now, when, Andrew? I fancy them for the 2018 World Cup. I think
they're number one in the world, are they not, in the FIFA World Rankings?
I haven't checked the FIFA World Rankings.
I'll double check. I thought they were. Yeah. I mean, they are the hunted now. Like, this is no more cute story. This is like legitimate expectations of winning whatever tournament they are a part of.
I thought they were very flat in the semi-final against France in 2018. I thought there was more that could be got out of the side. I wasn't sure about where the positions Hazard was picking up during that game. But you know, they're at a certain age and the winning window is open. And is Roberto Martinez going to open the window and climb through it? Or is he going to fall down the stairs, the fire escape, and waste this generation? That's a terrible analogy. That is so clunky. That did not work.
It was troubling.
We're going to workshop it. And we're going to get back to you. But that's the point. I think Belgium have to perform now. Immediately today, this summer, and in qualification going forward. They're the team I'm kind of keeping an eye out for.
Also, I mean, look, we have to talk about England for at least a second here.
Oh, boy.
We in a group with Poland, Hungary, Albania, Andorra, and San Marino.
So they're qualifying. They are qualifying, twirling a cane at a canter.
Well, I mean, look, Robert Lewandowski will have something to say about that.
The expectations, this is a group that screams England and qualifying. Yes. And getting there. And you know what? There might be the odd blip in a away draw in Poznan or maybe even a reverse in Poznan, a defeat, but they're going through.
Yeah, I mean, look, both England and Poland will feel that they should beat every other team that they face in this group. So how they do against each other will be important. And in certain respects, how you do against, you know, a San Marino, like your chance to build up that goal differential, should that wind up mattering in the end. But yes, I mean, on paper, I would say it's England's to lose. A couple stories with them. I guess the big story for this go around of internationals is that Gareth Southgate left Trent Alexander-Arnold out of the squad. And I think a lot of people were a little bit surprised to see that. He's going through a rough patch in form for much of the season with Liverpool, but not that rough. Right. But I guess many people had kind of thought that he had risen to a level where he was sort of a national team mainstay. And look, for right or wrong, Gareth Southgate has kind of trumpeted this idea all throughout that, you know, no one will be put on this team because of reputation. You will be put on this team because of how you're playing at any
given
moment.
Except Eric Dyer and a couple of others.
You know what? I can't argue with that. You're right. So, I don't know how you explain it unless this is like a lesson in motivation for a young player that he's trying to give out here. But I saw one player who I saw take note of it, JJ, was Trent's future manager, Steven Gerrard, who was highly critical, openly and publicly highly critical of Southgate's decision to not include the Liverpool fullback.
What did the last king of Scotland have to say?
I'll find the direct quotes, but he was basically like, you know, this isn't my team, so this what I have to say doesn't matter, but I disagree. I'll find for you exactly what he said.
Okay,
but
he didn't like it. Can I comment while you look and you find? Mm-hmm. Like there are so many good options for England right now in that position, and for me, not bringing Trent Alexander-Arnold says less about Trent Alexander-Arnold's season, his abilities, and what he could potentially do in an England side, or his versatility, more the conservative approach that this manager has built this team upon. And now that the manager has so many options, Kieran Trippier, because of suspension, hasn't played very much in the last few months, not his own fault, but he is a regular, he's going to be a starter, or is a starter right now for Atleti. So, you know, it's not crazy to bring him. He's also quite creative. If you look at, you know, the World Cup in 2018, how important Trippier was to that England team then. So it's not a shock that maybe Gareth Southgate prefers him, has more trust in him. But I just think,
I'm sorry to cut you off, but along those lines, Southgate said he spoke to Trent about it and cited guys like Kieran Trippier because, you know, this happened to them too, where they were big parts of the squad and then they weren't playing well and they were out and then back in again. So this doesn't mean the end of anything for Trent. No. It's just in this moment.
No, but I honestly think that come the summer, it's going to be a case of Trent Alexander-Arnold will probably at best find himself on the bench because this manager, is conservative, and the way the team will be set up for all their options will still be conservative. So do you want your, you know, very creative right back quasi midfielder playing, or do you want what you already know and the solidity of a more orthodox fullback?
Yeah. I have it here, JJ. This is future Liverpool manager, Steven Gerrard, on this Trent Alexander-Arnold situation. And he says, quote, Gareth Southgate makes the decisions there. I don't necessarily agree with that decision, but I'm not the England manager. I think Trent is the best English right back in the country. One thing I've learned from being a player is you can't always be a 10 out of 10. When you do come off, you need that support, love, and attention from your manager more than anyone else. So I was surprised by the decision, but that's my opinion. And my opinion is not important in this. Trent's a world-class right back. He's the best right back in the country that the country has got. We've got other fantastic right backs, by the way, but in terms of the loaded side of the question, I'm there for Trent and any of the other Liverpool players at any moment of the day.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He's not even manager yet, and he's extending his long arm across the border, across Hadrian's Wall, down the valleys, and into Liverpool. And these are long arms, and he's placing them around Trent Alexander-Arnold.
He really is.
Before we move on from... do you have anything else to say about England?
One other thing. One of my favorite things about this squad was that Jesse Lingard was called back in, which in itself I thought was just a great, like, you talk about Southgate living this mantra. I mean, Lingard is the example of a player who was in and then clearly out and now has played well at West Ham and he's back in again. But like just before you could get too excited and make it into too much of a feel good story, Southgate, he essentially came out and said that Lingard is lucky to be here. It's only because of injuries to other players. So like he's a tough one. He's getting very comfortable as the head man of this team and he's not afraid to exert his authority.
And allow me to pick further holes in is if you're in form, you get to play kind of mantra. Uh-huh. That mantra was not extended to Jack Grealish, who had to wait an absolute eternity to get his debut. So
you're right. There's holes in it.
There is indeed holes in it. One last thing as well. Mm-hmm. The Netherlands, Ronald Koeman.
I was about to bring them up.
Yeah. Can I just quickly say they're in a tricky group? And they start away in Turkey, in Istanbul. And if we think of their trajectory from the horror of missing out on two consecutive tournaments, major tournaments, you know, there was a feel-good factor brought in by Ronald Koeman. And now we've got Frankie boy, Frank de Boer, who has done nothing in club football. And now he's charged with continuing the good work of Ronald Koeman. And that group, they need a good start today, is what I'm saying, against Turkey. And this group needs to hit the ground running in qualifying, because they have potentially to face a very tricky run when you look at the other teams they have to play, including Norway in their group.
Yeah, and they start right away with what is probably their most difficult game, and that is at Turkey. It's in Istanbul, and they do it obviously without their leader and best player in Virgil van Dijk. And, I mean, look, you're right to be worried about De Boer. His era there started poorly. They didn't win any of his first four games in charge. Mm. They did win both of their matches under him last November. So it was a step in the right direction. But, yeah, there are question marks, and there's going to be a huge microscope on them, because, obviously, they didn't qualify for the last World Cup. They're kind of coming out of their dark period. And you know,
we thought they were.
Right. But you're right. That group is not – it's not simple. And I guess it's a good transition point, because one of the teams in that group is Norway. And we've said they're one of the up and coming teams in UEFA right now, in the world right now. And joining us to talk a little bit more about them is Jan Agafjortoft of ESPN FC, former player as well. Jan, how are you?
I'm fine. And how are you guys?
We're good. We're doing well. Good. And I'm wondering for Norway right now, they're kind of in this moment. That, you know, JJ and I have been talking about a little bit, Holland, Odegaard, World Cup qualifying getting underway. Where is the excitement level right now for the people of Norway with this team?
Well, I think it's very high because of three key factors, really. We have a new national coach, which is a young coach, Ståle Solbakken, who has been in Copenhagen. He tried his luck in Germany and England as well. Was not that successful, but he's a new generation of a national coach coming from that team that in the 90s had a good success. But of course, with Martin Ødegaard at Arsenal and Erling Braut Haaland, we are very optimistic, as we always are when we start the qualification. The problem is, of course, that we are a very small country, so you are very depending on your generations. But this new generation, they're first of all good lads, great attitude, they're training hard to improve themselves. The problem we have, or the challenge, is that we don't have a great balance in our team. So for every goal Braut Haaland will score, we'll be worried that we will let in one at the back. Maybe not against Gibraltar, but in general.
Yeah, and I remember the I don't want to call them a golden generation, but the 94 and 98 teams of which you were a part. How does this team compare in general?
Interesting question, because we've never had a world-class player before, because Erling is a world-class striker and every club in the world wants him. I think in the 90s, what was good about the 90s team was that the age balance was better than this one. We had Rune Bratseth and you had Erik Thorsvedt, two old statesmen who have been around in Europe for a long time. And then I was maybe in the middle segment, 3-4 players there. And then we have a young generation of Lars Bohin and Stig Inge Bjørneby and the likes of them coming up, Øyvind Leonardsen. This team now, we have a club captain or a national team captain, he's 22, is Martin Ødegaard. I was the manager of the Norwegian national team when we took him in, he was 15. And it feels like he's been around forever. You have Erling Haaland, who is 20. You have Hauge from Milan, who is like 23 or something. Then you have Sander Berg, who is just a kid. So, but in terms of talents, I've never seen as more excitement than we have now.
Yeah, and this chat is great. Norway, you know, back on the international stage with probably, at the moment, the best striker in the world. But this might all be academic if they decide to boycott the World Cup 22 in Qatar. How has this come about? How has Norway decided, or at least some prominent figures in Norwegian football decided to take this stance?
Well, first of all, I'm standing now when I speak to you guys, because I'm going to a meeting and I'm standing with our national arena, Ullevaal Stadium. And I think there are some people inside here who are very worried about that.
Wow.
There was an initiative which I still think is a good initiative. We all know that the nomination to take the World Cup to Qatar was the wrong one. And you see the people who voted for that time, it was not the right reasons, because they are more or less all kicked out, and half of them had to more or less go to prison because of corruption. So there was an initiative from one club called Tromsø in Norway that on their assembly, in the yearly assembly, they should vote for an or against the boycott, and which is not surprisingly, when members kind of think of that, they will think that the boycott is a good idea, because it's a way, is a desperate way to say to the International Football Federation or the sports federations that we can't go on like we're doing at the moment and be run by corrupt leaders as we are. And so the action in itself, and it started growing. And then the Norwegian Football Association had a general assembly 2 weeks ago. And instead of taking that up to a vote, and our national coach, obviously, of course, desperate to avoid this, because we know there is a big reason. Well, if we boycott that, we couldn't have played a qualification either. And that is bad for a young generation. And people like myself, I'm against the boycott because I think that there are better ways to do it. I think that a boycott will help maybe us Norwegians to feel better. But I think that we have to do different actions. So to do that, maybe like the national team planned to do tonight, we're all excited what kind of actions they will do tonight. Having said that, I respect that action to send a signal to the International Federation. So what I did at the General Assembly, they made now an extraordinary General Assembly who will meet at the 20th of June. And they will then put down a committee leaded by a guy in Norway. And today they were nominated, and all the critics as well are in that committee, and they will make a recommendation to the assembly. And then there will be a vote, and it's a one club, one vote. I think maybe the top clubs will have two votes. So it's a bit excitement what will happen, because this is a grassroots action. And what we have learned over the past years, grassroots action should never be underestimated.
No, certainly not. And how much weight does it carry, the fact that Rosenborg, the most successful club in Norwegian football, appear to be behind the idea of a boycott?
Yeah, and not even that. We had a survey in Norway, and it was like 55% said yes to a boycott. And of course, when Rosenborg, I mean, the leaders of Rosenborg didn't want to boycott, but the members would. And I guess it was Churchill who said that democracy is bad, but look at the alternatives. So you just have to kind of respect what is going on, and for sure the football leaders haven't done their job. The football leaders and the sport leaders in the world, they need to be told. And then I think that the rest of it's all about which kind of action is the right one to change something. If that's a boycott, well, maybe then we should go for a boycott. If not, we should try something else. And it's fair to say that dialogue hasn't worked. But now, as I think a lot of these people, and including myself, we need to get more knowledge, and then we'll see what we do in Norway the 20th of June. I just see, if I may say, that a boycott won't have a big influence when you see that the big clubs like Manchester City, PSG, Bayern Munich, they have all got big connections in the Arab world. So I can't see that will have a major thing. But having said that, I can understand that they want to send a signal to the leaders.
Jan, it's going to be very interesting, because whether they want to be a part of this or not, the players of this Norwegian team are going to be thrust into the middle of this. They're going to be asked about this. It's going to come up with regularity. Have we started to get any idea of their feelings on this boycott? It's a complicated position for them, for sure.
Absolutely, and a very good point, because Ståle Solbakken has been, I think he's been fantastic the last 2-3 weeks, trying to find his way between not losing the chance to play football games and develop a young Norwegian team, as we spoke for at the beginning. The players have so far said, so Martin Ødegaard, Erling Haaland said, we are discussing this, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it together. It's not that like one and one player will do their stuff. They've already had one meeting, and the national coach told them, if someone of you have a bad conscience about anything, just tell me, then we'll find a way to sort it out with you. But you know, the problem is with teams. I remember back in the days when I was in the Norwegian national team, Lars Bohinen, he wanted to boycott, or he boycotted our game against France, because France had some bomb testing, bombs, yeah, nuclear testing in the Pacific, and you know how footballers are, because I remember at that meeting. It was down here in Oslo, and we had a meeting and before the game against France, and every player wanted to boycott everything. And I remember I asked the team, can you just, the people of you who wants to boycott, can you just stand up and tell us what is this all about? Because Lars Bohine knows, and Lars Bohine has taken the consequences of his opinion and his conscience. And it ended up as making a statement of it. And I think that football is, I think that it's wise what they've done now. They will say, we will do it as a team. I think that is wise, because, and then individuals have to say their opinion. If they want to boycott there, well, that we need to be respected as well.
Just one more quick question on this, Jan. Are the Norwegian people as a whole a socially active people? Are they a people that protest, that are concerned about the larger things going on in the world?
Well, it's a major question, and I have to be aware now what I say. I think the Norwegian, we find that we can use our position, and we've shown that in the movement of peace, in different places in the world, we could have played a role. Although we are a part of NATO, we're a small country, have played a role. I think the Norwegians are very conscious about those kind of things. I think that we want to be involved. Sometimes it's a problem because we are somehow the rich people at the top of Europe with our oil and gas and everything God has given us and things like that. So I think that sometimes it's important for a Norwegian. I'm very proud Norwegian, but we Norwegians sometimes gotta understand when maybe what happened in Norway, people have to ask for it, that they will have the Norwegian model. But having said that, I find the Norwegians still that we are pumping up oil and gas. We are very into environment. That is a paradox. So there is a lot of things you can say about Norwegians, but I think that we want to have it clean. If you visited Norway, it's a very, very clean country, and people are very trustful over each other. So we react on unfairness, and that's what I like about this action, because there is a lot of things that could be for or against, but you have to get rid of these corrupt leaders.
So Jan, to bring it back to the football of this, let's say that Norway, they do forge ahead and they are going to take part, at least in qualifying. It's a tricky group. Netherlands, Turkey, Norway, Montenegro, Latvia, and Gibraltar probably at the bottom of the group. But what is the sense? Can Norway navigate their way through this?
Like every other country, when we start the qualification, we think that we will qualify again. Last time we qualified for a championship was in 2000. That was the European Championship. And then 98, Brazil, and the USA, 94. Before that, we didn't qualify since 1938. So it's not like it is a tradition in this country. But it's like when you have Erling Haaland, when you have a player like Martin Ødegaard, who kind of was a man of the match, a game against West Ham, you just think that everything is possible. But like you said, it's a difficult group. We'll probably beat Gibraltar tonight, but the next game is Turkey. That should be in the national arena that I have a look at now. But we have to play that game in Spain as well. So that takes that home advantage away from it. So I'm worried about the balance in the team. I'm very worried about the balance in the team because I've played in the 90s with great defenders, and the most great teams are based on great defenders. So I'm a bit worried about that, but I love the national team. I've been a fan, I've been a player, I've been a manager, and we've worked in TV with the national team. And I love this feeling when everything is possible before the qualification group starts.
Yeah, and final one from me, because it just kind of, the quote broke this morning from Matthias Sammer, who you'll remember as a player, no doubt. I'm sure you came up against him a lot. He was a tough character, and he's the technical director at Borussia Dortmund. And I know he's probably just pouring water on the fires a little bit about a potential Erling Braut Haaland transfer, but he said that as a striker, he has much more to go. He's not the finished product. I read a great article recently about the fact that apart from putting the ball in the net and doing certain striker things, he doesn't do very much else in the game. You played center forward, you played as a striker. Do you see as much area for improvement as Matthias Sammer does?
Well, first of all, I disagree on the other thing that he only scored goals, because I think I've never seen a player in my life, and in my whole life as a striker, that is better to create spaces for himself, okay, to avoid offside, just to avoid offside. Indeed, this boy never goes in offside. And also the way that how he uses tools when he do different things. I mean, that is fantastic. How when to shoot hard, when to low, when to do this. Of course, there are areas that he can be better at. Before this season, we said that keep the ball up, play with his teammates, do his play up with the teammates, his heading abilities. But the funny thing is, now we are coming to the end of March, and a lot of these things he has approved already. And the good thing about Erling Braut Haaland, there is no one who works harder on these weaknesses. And of course, Matthias Sammer will say that he has to improve. And I think that he is right. There are areas that he can be better at, but he has this ability to always look for where he can improve. And hopefully, in the process of improving these kind of things, he will still keep on this passion, this terrifying, this eye of the tiger that he got. Mm. And I think that is the main thing for a striker. And mind you, another thing, because we said he only scored goals, when he can play, he can run one against one against a goalkeeper, but he will still play a teammate that is in a better position. Well, I scored 308 goals in my career in four different countries. Mm-hmm. I never saw a teammate when I went one against one against a goalkeeper. I only saw the goal. So I think that he got a lot of skills, this boy, and he can be as good as there's no limits for him.
I'm going to ask a cheeky one here. It's a two-parter, and I promise this is the last one. Are you in touch with his father? And B, would what happened between Roy Keane and Alfinga Haaland stop a potential move to Manchester United, or is the real sticking post in this Mino Raiola?
No. First of all, if you see the career of Team Haaland, and I include the dad and the advisor, Raiola, there's nothing so far that's shown that he's only going after one thing, that is development. He went from Brünner to Molde because Molde was the best place to go. Salzburg could have gone to Juventus, earned a lot of more money, played with fantastic players, didn't do it, went to Salzburg because it was the best place to go. And then he went to Dortmund. He said no to Manchester United at that point. Not that he didn't want to play for Manchester United, but because he felt that Dortmund was the best place to develop. And I can see, and I speak a lot to Alfie, and I speak to Erling. We have the rights to the Champions League and the German Bundesliga. Mm-hmm. And there is he will look for the club where he can develop. And if his dad was kicked down by Roy Keane, or he was the captain of Manchester City, or he played with Leeds United, that won't do any irrelevant difference at all, because he has already said no to Manchester United, who had his former coach at Molde. So this boy is just going after his development. And if Alfie, the way he played, then nobody should have him, because he did some bad tackles as well. Not as bad as Roy Keane, but still, these guys are very professional.
Yeah, he'll end up at Middlesbrough and continue the great legacy of Norwegian strikers at Middlesbrough.
Exactly. But it's hard for him to come to Middlesbrough, but there's no way that he can do better than the other Norwegian striker was there. So I can't see that happening.
Jan Åge Fjørtoft, great stuff. We appreciate your time, and we look forward to catching up again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Really enjoyed that with Jan. He's great, man.
He's so interesting. I love listening to him talk about football. And it's great to have him on ESPN FC.
Yeah.
What a complicated problem faced by.
Yeah.
Because if I'm a Norwegian supporter, I know how this goes. You know, it's not like they qualify regularly. They haven't been at a tournament in a long, long time. You know, they're kind of in Republic of Ireland territory in terms of qualifying for things. And suddenly you've got the best striker in the world and you're not going, even though lots of other nations are holding their nose and they're going to go anyway. I mean, I applaud the stand in a way, but I also understand why some people would be like, why us? Why are we doing this?
Yeah. And it always kind of goes back to the idea of what exactly is the role of sports? Is it, you know, to make a stand by boycotting, or is it to go and show some kind of unity and try to, you know, almost change from within? I don't know. I don't know if there's any right answer. I don't know which accomplishes more. I mean, I can, in my own head, I can go back a little bit to how I felt this past summer when there was some talk when, you know, remember JJ, when the NBA went into their bubble in Orlando, and it was right around the time of George Floyd and the protests, and there was talk about the NBA players wanting to boycott in the name of change and social justice. And there was that famous meeting that was held where it sounded like, you know, LeBron basically was like, well, you know, we're playing and that's it. And something to that effect. Yeah, and I remember how I was feeling then, that I kind of believe that being there and being present can do more in the way of inspiring change by, like, they can bring attention to this in every press conference. They can find any number of ways to keep the issue prevalent throughout the tournament when the eyes of the entire world will be on them. A boycott, it certainly also raises a ton of attention in the buildup. So if that was the route they chose to go to make their statement, I wouldn't tell them that that's wrong. But then I wonder if it becomes, well, the tournament goes on, Norway's not here, out of sight, out of mind, and now the issue isn't even really being addressed because the team who would have addressed it while we're here isn't here. So look, I don't know. I don't know which is the more effective route.
I don't know either, and increasingly it's harder to find a purity and a moral high ground in football. I mean, look at the league we watch week in, week out, from Manchester City's ownership to the Champions League with PSG. I mean, we've already made huge compromises. Look at Russia and look at Brazil and South Africa. Should there have been World Cups in any of those countries? Probably not. I can go through each one and lay out the case that there shouldn't be World Cups there. Look at the World Cup that's coming forward. Whether we like it or not, there will be plenty of countries who will have a problem with the Canada, Mexico, United States World Cup. So, I know there's degrees of the game. But yeah, it's so difficult now to clean up this mess that's been implemented by a previous FIFA regime, when corruption, as Jan pointed out, led us to the point of the awarding of the last two World Cups. I think the conversation is important, but there is no right or wrong in this one.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I believe I saw just today that talking about the previous regime, that Sepp Blatter has been banned again by FIFA, 6 years. So I don't know when we'll be seeing him again.
Andrew, if you have a chance, please insert "I am the president of everybody" drop here.
We'll look for it. Let's see, JJ, do we have a mailbag, do we not?
Oh, we have a mailbag. CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com is the email way to reach us. @CUSoccerPod on Twitter, CaughtOffsideESPN on Instagram. Thank you to everyone who joins in with our Friday chats. They're tremendous fun. So much fun. And it's a good way to kind of to round off your week. If you guys think of a better time than 4 p.m., the traveling time for everyone commuting home that we do this, please let me know, because I am being quite selfish that's the hour. I'm sure there's a more convenient hour for other people. Beto in Austin, Texas.
The Beto O'Rourke?
Yeah, well, no. No.
Could be Austin, Texas.
That's not his name. Oh. This is an abbreviated name. It could be. I don't know. Hey guys, first off, love listening every week from Austin, Texas. Thank you. I honestly get excited every time I see a new episode drop. You're both great. Appreciate that, Beto. JJ, it can get extremely frustrating listening to your anti-Jose rants. Mourinho is a character for sure, but it's not often that people hate someone so much that everything they do is discredited. As soon as his appointment was announced, it felt that you have blatantly hoped for the failure of his tenure and that Spurs would implode. If Spurs were relegated, you would celebrate because that would mean that Jose would be out of a job. It's exhausting yelling at you to get over your anti-Mourinho ways while I'm sitting in my vehicle stuck in traffic. It's too much and I don't even care that much about him. Anyway, on another note, you guys have encouraged me to watch the MLS, and now I'm looking forward to having an MLS team in my city. Thanks again for your hard work. Beto, thanks for your email. Just a quick one. It's exhausting for you yelling at me to get over my anti-Mourinho ways. It's exhausting being right, Beto, about about Mourinho. And look, I will address this. I didn't want him to fail. In fact, I'm the guy that thought in this COVID low block era of football before Christmas, when Spurs were top of the league, I thought, you know what, this might work. I was one of the people that said that. So I don't hate him. That is just such a reductive thing. One of my favorite teams is the 2010 Inter team, but I just saw no way that this could work. So knowing that it can't work, knowing that you're going to have a specific type and brand of football, is different from hating someone. I don't hate him. That's not true. But you are right about one thing. It is exhausting, and I have nothing new to say about him. And I think I'm getting boring about him, and we're going to move on. And I'm going to not stop talking about him, but I'm definitely going to try and talk about some different angle because I'm boring myself and I'm probably boring you guys too as well. Just this is probably a good spot to mention Gareth Bale's comments about returning to Madrid and not staying on at Spurs, Andrew, if you'd like
to. Yeah, so I saw that. I guess I can't say I'm surprised by it. I don't know that Tottenham will necessarily be disappointed by that. I wonder what Real Madrid thinks of this. Like, you know, so Bale said essentially that he wanted to leave Real Madrid for this season because he wanted to go somewhere where he could play because he wanted to make sure that he was ready for Wales. So look, if Tottenham were used for that purpose, so be it. I mean, I suppose it was on paper a situation where everybody wins. Bale would play. Tottenham fans would be happy to see one of their heroes back in the Tottenham kit again. Hopefully he would help the team, and so be it. In the end, I think everyone kind of lost. Bale has not played a ton. It has not gone great. He had a brief patch where the Bale backometer was you know, up at 9, but it quickly dropped back to 3, 4. So if this was his goal to come to Tottenham and prove that he is the Gareth Bale that we knew him to be a couple years ago, I don't know that that's happened. Look, he'll still be Wales's best player. But if this, you know, if he's just assuming, okay, now I go back to Real Madrid and continue on, we'll see what Madrid thinks. I don't know.
Matt Kilfoyle, he wrote to us on the back of our top three Irish goals last week for St. Patrick's Day, and tells us the story of Jason McAteer standing up and refusing an invitation from Bono of U2. So basically the crux of this story is U2 were playing a massive gig at Slane Castle in County Meath, which would be an hour and a half outside Dublin. And on the same day as Ireland were playing Holland in the crucial World Cup qualifier, McAteer scores, they win the game. And apparently Bono was at the game. He was going to get a helicopter then to Slane to do the gig. And he asked Jason McAteer to come on stage with him in front of, I was at the gig, by the way.
Oh, wow.
In front of 80,000 of us. At Slane, like the place was absolutely packed. It's one of the best concerts I've ever been at. And McAteer basically said, no, I'm going on the beer in Dublin with John Aldridge.
Wow. Imagine.
Yeah. And at the gig, they opened with Beautiful Day, and right at the end, Bono comes out waving a tricolor and goes, beautiful goal, and talks about Jason McAteer for a few minutes. And I'm like, he can go on the beer anytime he wants with John Aldridge.
So that was my takeaway from this is, so this has just happened. And so then Jason looks over at John, presumably, and says, all right, ready? And John, like, now the pressure on John Aldridge to show him like the time of his life, you just refused this moment with Bono to have a beer with me. Like, I can't live up to this. This isn't fair. No, go.
Yeah. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Patrick Conway, I'm a longtime listener and first time sender to the mailbag. I've listened to you through college and have been a constant as I now start a job as a teacher. None of my sixth graders seem interested in listening, but I'm working on it. Patrick, forget the curriculum. Get them downloading. Thank you. After this past weekend's North London Derby, I've started thinking, why does it seem like Harry Kane is constantly getting away with dirty challenges? That challenge in Gabriel was a borderline red offence, and it seemed like VAR didn't even take a look. The part that was more surprising to me was that it was a challenge no one in the British media seemed to talk about. He also seems to constantly be ducking when defenders go up for headers, which I'm surprised has not caused any serious head neck injuries to date. This is also something I feel no one in the British media is talking about. Is it just because I'm an uncultured American who is overreacting, or could there be some truth to England's captain getting the benefit of the doubt in media coverage? Would love to hear your thoughts and the impact the media has had on how we view specific players, and if there are any other media agendas helping and hurting players. So Patrick, that challenge, we'll deal first with the challenge in Gabriel, because we didn't talk about it on the podcast. There was so many other issues that came up. I mean, I tweeted at the time that it reminded me of the horrendous challenge Ben Thatcher did on Pedro Mendes. Ben Thatcher was playing for Manchester City and he basically broke the guy's jaw as he slammed into him on the sideline. Now, it's not as bad as that, but it was nasty. And if I'm VAR, I'm sending him off for it.
Really? You thought it was red?
Yeah, I thought it was red.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the second time I watched it, not maybe in live play, but the second, third, fourth time I watched it, and that's why I was surprised VAR didn't get involved. He's not gone for the ball, Andrew. He's dropped the shoulder and he's smashed into the side of Gabriel's head. That's why I compared it to Ben Thatcher. It is not as bad as that. But the pattern of where he ducks in under defenders and flips them over, I mean, there's just no question. He does that almost every single game. There's a montage on Twitter of him doing it, and it is dangerous. As to the British media not talking about England's darling centre forward, that happened before with Alan Shearer. Alan Shearer was extremely combative in a time where people would argue he had to be because of the nature of the game and being a centre forward coming up against some pretty tough centre backs. But he was portrayed as the angel of the North, this man from the sceptred isle who would bring England to great glory in the media. And it wasn't really talked about how combative, let's call it that. I won't say violent, but how combative he could be. For me, Kane isn't like that, but he is with that specific challenge where he backs into defenders and causes them to flip over. I mean, it's really, really dangerous.
Yeah. He does do that. He's not the only player that I see do that, mm-mm. But you're right. I mean, that's legitimate. With respect to the challenge on Gabriel, look, to me, it was a clear yellow. The fact that he escaped any card at all was surprising to me. I guess the only reason that I didn't look at it and think, oh, that's a red, is just because
shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah. Or it could be I guess I'm just not used to seeing something that looks like that be a red. And I think that had it been given as a red, we'd be sitting here having the opposite conversation right now. Oh, you know, it's physical play. It's an important game, North London Derby. You got to let these guys be physical. Give them a red for that. It's Harry Kane. You don't like, we could just as easily be going the other way on something like on a play like that. That isn't, you know, when a guy goes in two-footed, studs up like what Lamella did, elbow to the head. We're used to seeing those things given as reds. A hard shoulder to someone's side. And the reason it turned out to be Gabriel's head is because Gabriel ducks. So, you know, it's hard for Kane to kind of like change up split second like that because Gabriel is ducking. But it's mainly shoulder to shoulder, I think. And it's very hard and it's late and it's a yellow. To me, I'm watching it again, actually, as we speak. It's not a red.
Okay.
But you know, look, I don't know if I'm in the minority on that, so be it. But no, yeah. To me that I would have had a problem with him being sent off.
There's no question. Kane has now kind of developed a reputation, certainly, in the online community over some of his challenges, but there we are. Robert, Sonny SoCal Rob, does Andrew know about the show Mighty Ducks Game Changers? I remember on a past show that Andrew stated that the character of Gordon Bombay was based on Andrew's past where he himself got a DUI and had to coach a little league ice hockey team. Does he remember and will he watch?
So that moment, for anyone who's now hearing that for the first time, it's one of my least favorite things that I've said on the show, because I think it showed me how few people had seen Mighty Ducks. Like, I made a joke pretending, I guess, that like I was Gordon Bombay, and the joke didn't land. And next thing I know, on like the next week's podcast, we had all this mail from people thinking that I had gotten a DUI and had to coach a minor league, a youth hockey team. And I was like, no, that wasn't actually me. I was kidding. That's a story from a movie called Mighty Ducks. Has no one seen it? And no one had. So people thought I was talking about myself. Now I have seen this Mighty Ducks Game Changers. I guess they're kind of doing sort of like what Karate Kid did with Cobra Kai, like the updated, you know, here they are today, like right. Continuation of it. So I'll watch this. I'm very curious about it, but I will reiterate once again, for anyone who needs to hear it, I have never gotten a DUI. I believe that drinking and driving is a terrible thing to do. You put yourself at danger and those around you. I was joking. It was a story from a movie, and hopefully that's been cleared up now yet again, and we can all continue on with our lives.
Wow. Well, thank you for that clarification, Andrew. And that was the Mail Beezy. Leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere else you can leave us a review. Write to your senator and ask him for more CO Soccer Pod.
Let's see. Let's do this now. Yeah. Red card. Can I go first, JJ?
You may. Seeing as I don't have a red card this week, I've broken the rules again.
Why? Why? It's so simple. It's one simple rule. One bad, one good. We continue on with our week. Why can't you just follow the rules? I don't understand. At any rate, all right. My red card, JJ, we hit some really frightening scenes in Haiti the other day as the Belize national team was there for a World Cup qualifier and had had their bus held up by what I've seen referred to as both an armed gang and armed insurgents. The bus had a police escort. They had only just gotten to Haiti, and I believe they were en route to the team hotel, but they were stopped by this group and essentially forced the police that were escorting the bus were essentially forced to negotiate with the group to allow them to pass peacefully. I'm reading here now from the BBC. Captain Dion McCauley described the incident as, quote, a moment of intense fear. I'm happy everyone is safe, and I commend you guys for being brave, he added. Let's continue to stick together and please make the best decisions when it comes to the team. An image of the Federation's Facebook page showed the gang on motorbikes wearing masks and carrying weapons.
Jeez, I'm looking at it now. Holy.
In a statement, the FFB said, quote, the Football Federation of Belize takes this time to express its disappointment and disgust at an unfortunate incident faced by the Jaguars. The team was headed from the airport to the hotel in Haiti. Despite the four-man police escort, the team bus was stopped by an uproar of insurgents with assault rifles on motorcycles, and police escorts were forced to negotiate with them for the team bus to continue its journey to the hotel. We are pleased to report that our Jaguars, although shaken by the terrible experience, are safely at their hotel. Frightening incident for sure. When you hear about these moments on team buses, you know, you think of some of the recent events that happened to Togo, Borussia Dortmund. Fortunately, this wound up not rising to either of those levels, not even close. But I'm sure for all those involved, it was some tense moments nevertheless. So we're glad that everyone in the end is safe. But a scary scene for the Belize national team.
The pictures are terrifying. There's guys with, I mean, what can only be described as military-grade automatic weapons.
Yeah.
It's truly scary. Seeing as I can't do anything normally or be a normal person on this podcast, my man of the match, part one, is Alfonso Davies, who became the first goodwill ambassador for UN, the refugee agency. So there's never been a footballer in this role. He's not the first ambassador, but he is the first football ambassador. Accepting his new role as UNHCR goodwill ambassador, Davies said, I am proud to join the UN Refugee Agency as a goodwill ambassador. My own experiences make me want to speak up for refugees, to share their stories, and to help make a difference. Born in a refugee camp in Ghana to Liberian parents who fled the civil war in their home country, Davies knows firsthand what it means to be a refugee. Whilst the refugee camp provided a safe place for my family when they fled war, I often wonder where I would have been if I had stayed there and not benefited from the opportunities I got thanks to resettlement. I don't think I would have made it to where I am today. I want people to know about the importance of helping refugees wherever they are, in camps or cities, in neighboring countries or countries of resettlement such as Canada. Refugees need our support to survive, but also access to education and sports so they can fulfill their potential and truly thrive. That is his journey is amazing. It continues to be amazing. I can't think of a better ambassador to talk about this particular issue and something that is, I mean, really, even since 2014, 2015, been front and center in our world news. Congrats to him. A deserved role and something he can really prosper with in spreading education about this.
Nice. That's great. Let's see, JJ, my woman of the match this week. Props to Sam Mewis. In a bit of synergy, as this is an ESPN podcast, and now I'm going to reference an ESPN FC article. Don't ever badmouth synergy, Lemon. That's a line from 30 Rock. This week, ESPN FC ranked their top 50 women's players in the game today, and they ranked Sam Mewis, the 28-year-old American, number one in the world overall. Kathleen McNamee did the write-up on her. It's all very well said. You should go check it out. Some of what she says, Mewis's transformation from a player who didn't make the 2015 U.S. Women's World Cup or 2016 Olympic squad to someone who Vlatko Andonovski calls, quote, a true example of what the U.S. Women's National Team stands for is remarkable. Her arrival to the Women's Super League in August 2020 Might not have been considered the most star-studded signing of the summer, but it arguably has had the most immediate and lasting impact. She slotted straight into Gareth Taylor's starting lineup and has contributed a number of crucial goals, including in January when she scored the game winner in the FA Cup final for Manchester City. And add into this her sensational U.S. women's national team form. She scored her first career hat trick against Colombia. Since February 28th, she scored 6 goals, 3 in the league, 3 in the UEFA Women's Champions League. Props to Sam Mewis. I believe, actually, I saw Manchester City are in action right now in the Women's Champions League. I think they are losing 2-0 on the first leg to Barcelona.
Yeah, that's just gone full-time. 3-0.
3-0. Oh,
yeah.
They're going to have a mountain to climb in the second leg.
Yeah.
I think that's March 31st. So keep an eye on that. In case you were wondering, JJ, here is what the rest of the top 10 looked like.
Okay.
Like I said, Sam Mewis was number one. 10 was Dabinha of Brazil and North Carolina Courage. 9 was Caroline Graham Hansen of Norway and Barcelona. Number 8, Julie Ertz of the U.S. and Chicago. 7 was Zenifer Marazan of Germany and Lyon. Crystal Dunn, number 6 for Portland in the U.S. Lucy Bronze of Manchester City also and England was 5th. Pernille Harder of Chelsea and Denmark was 4th. Number 3, Vivian Miedema of Arsenal and the Netherlands. And number 2, Sam Kerr of Chelsea and Australia. Other notable Americans to make the top 50, Tobin Heath, Rose Lavelle was 15th, Lindsay Horan, Kristen Press, Abby Dahlkamper, Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, and Becky Sauerbrunn was 45th. So a couple takeaways from this. One, every time I watch Rose Lavelle play, I'm blown away by how great I think she is.
You don't get to see it very often.
I know. I can't believe she's not a top 10 player in the world. She's had some injuries. So obviously, I mean, that must play a role in it as this is kind of like a current list. And second observation from this list, 11 of the 50 on the list are Americans. That says pretty much all you need to know about how great this current team is. Over a fifth of the list plays for the U.S. So props to the U.S. women, props to Sam Mewis, specifically number one in the world.
I'm not criticizing Gareth Taylor, and I know you mentioned injuries, but Rose Lavelle came in the 70th minute. Mm-hmm. If you were looking for annoying things that annoy U.S. soccer fans on Twitter or social media, Rose Lavelle not starting games regularly for Manchester City is right up there. Mewis being the key cog in that team doesn't matter. They are incensed every time she doesn't start. And Gareth Taylor he's not on the good list, I'll put it that way. My second man of the match, I've never read a managerial resignation statement quite like Cesare Prandelli's from Fiorentina today. It was moving, scary, dark, everything. I'm reading from ESPN FC right now. Cesare Prandelli has released a powerful statement following his decision to resign as manager of Fiorentina on Tuesday, where he said he stepped down because of a darkness which has grown inside him. The ex-Italy boss also managed at Parma, Valencia, and briefly Roma, where he left without taking charge of an official match because his wife became ill. He was out of the game for almost 2 years before short stints at Genoa and Fiorentina, where he has quit after only 4 months in charge. "It is the second time I leave Fiorentina," Prandelli wrote. "The first due to the will of others. Today, because of my decision. In everyone's life, aside from beautiful things, we also accumulate waste, poison, which at times comes up all at once. In this moment of my life, I find myself in huge discomfort, which stops me from being who I am. I took on this new experience with joy and love, carried also by the enthusiasm. It is probably because I love this city too much, because of the beautiful sporting memories I have, that I was blind to the first signs that something wasn't right. Something wasn't exactly right within me. My decision comes from the enormous responsibility I have first and foremost for the players and the club, but also the respect I have for the Fiorentina fans. Whoever goes on the pitch at this level without doubt has a specific talent. Whoever has talent is sensitive, and I would never want my own discomfort to be perceived and condition the team's displays. In these months, a darkness has grown inside me, which has changed my way of looking at things. I came here to give 100%, but as soon as I had the feeling this was no longer possible for the benefit of everyone, I took a step back." He goes on to thank Rocco Commisso and his family and the owners. "I am aware that this might mean the end of my managerial career, but I have no regrets and I don't wish to have any. It is probable that this world, which I've been a part of all my life, is no longer for me and I don't recognize myself in it anymore. I am sure I have changed and the world moves quicker than I thought. For this reason, I believe the moment has arrived for me to no longer be dragged at this speed and to stop and rediscover who I really am." That is
Wow. That is unbelievable. Right. Not your typical resignation letter.
No, it's he's clearly struggling with something. It's today is the same day that Alvaro Morata has spoken about mental health in sports. So I don't want to say the usual cliche. I think he's very brave, but there's something going on. It's not helping him to be manager of Fiorentina. And so he's stepping away. He also had huge success in his first stint. He took them into the Champions League. So, you know, he's a well-regarded coach in Florence. And I don't know, I read it a couple of times and it was very dark. So the very best to him. And I appreciate his candor and his bravery. There, I said, wow. He's bravery.
Remember, JJ, I think it was after Frank Lampard stepped down. We went through the checklist. Yeah.
Right.
Will he be thanked for his service? Will he be wished well? Will he be welcomed back?
Yes.
I would hope that Prandelli gets the hat trick here.
I hope he gets the hat trick. I think he deserves it based on his first stint. And if Frank Lampard got it for bringing the team to the Champions League, then so should Prandelli.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, man. Well, that's our show.
What
great
a podcast.
Stuff today. Yeah.
Good Lord. And before we get out, Andrew, we should briefly mention U.S. Olympic qualifying.
Yes, yes.
So the team play Mexico tonight, I believe, which depending on when you're listening to this is the Wednesday. This is a game which doesn't really matter because both sides have qualified for the semifinals. The US basically need to win their semifinal on Sunday. Then they go to the Olympics. We don't know who they'll play yet in that game. They've already beaten Costa Rica and the Dominican Republic, two performances that were a bit meh. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, they were negotiated. Mexico, obviously, and then one more game before we break a cycle that hasn't seen us qualify since 2008.
Which is unacceptable, and you really hope that they do break it now. This game, you're right in that it doesn't really matter. Both teams, Mexico and the U.S. under-23s, are going on to the semis. But it could be a nice gauge of seeing where this U.S. team is, because this Mexican team is loaded and is probably the favorite to win this qualifying tournament. So we'll at least get a sense of where this U.S. group is at.
Yeah, there's a few players that have impressed me. Vines in particular. Sam Vines has been very good. I thought Ewell made a big difference in the second half against the Dominican Republic, but they went almost an hour without scoring on DR, which is... not great, but
when they did, the floodgates did open
and Dotson was important for the US as well, the couple of substitutions that Jason Christ made, but look, it's within reach, put it that way.
Yep. Our thanks to Jan Agafjortoft. Sometimes it's weird to still get impressed by certain things, JJ, but like he's in his car outside of a stadium in Oslo.
Yeah.
And he may as well have been sitting right next to us. Like, is it weird or sad in some way that I still get impressed sometimes by like where technology has gone in the last 5 years?
No. Your weirdness and sadness come from other things much deeper within you.
Okay.
No, it's great. It's amazing. He's outside Norway's national stadium in this huge moment for Norwegian football and for the protest that possibly will happen tonight against Gibraltar. And he's talking to little old me and little old Andrew. It's great. I'll be floating on a cloud for the rest of the day having talked to him.
Yeah,
he also complimented my Dutch jersey. So
that's true. Before he came on, that was off the air.
Yeah, he has the original Bergkamp from 94. So he's doing a bit better than me.
He's a one-upper. The fact that he had to tell you that, he's just a one-upper. That's all he is. Well, hey, this was fun, man. Enjoy the rest of your week. Enjoy some of these internationals. We didn't even mention Ireland. They're in action as well. Best of luck.
Thank you very much. Away at Serbia should be an easy one.
Yeah, okay. Those are always easy.
Yeah.
But hey, this was fun, man. To you, I say...
check you later, phone boy.
See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.